You be who you are.
This is special coverage from WBUR in Boston. I'm Tom Ashbrook. In the next year, over 50 million people will die unnecessarily from preventable diseases and starvation around the world. That number is 8 times greater than the Holocaust and equal to more than 10,000 World Trade Center disasters. What happened to globalization's promise of global prosperity? This hour, we're checking in on the global economy and asking if there's a way to do things better. But first, the continuing recession on the home front. A panel of economists from the National Bureau of Economic Research confirmed today that the American economy did enter a recession in March, ending 10 years of growth, the longest period of uninterrupted economic growth in the country's history. Greg Ipp joins me now. He's an economics reporter with the Wall Street Journal in Washington, D.C. Hello, Greg Ipp.
Hi, Tom. How are you?
We're well, thanks. It's official now. The recession started in March, but what most people want to know is, Greg, when is it going to end?
Well, as you know, the NBER, when they make these decisions, they wait quite a while so they get enough data to make sure they don't have to take the decision back a few months later if everything turns around.
Mm-hmm.
So what we have here is a statement of the past, not of the future. Now, the following is as much we know. The average post-war recession has lasted 11 months. So if we're still in recession, this one's gone 8 months. So if it were to go according to plan, we would have 3 more months to go. And in fact, there are some signs out there that we are actually approaching the bottom, if we're not already there. First of all, the stock market is up about 20% from its low, and you seldom get a rally of that magnitude when you're still in a recession.
Mm-hmm.
Secondly, you have seen some positive indicators in real activity. For example, the number of people collecting unemployment insurance for the first time has dropped steadily for the last 4 weeks. And finally, there have been some encouraging signs that retail sales, although they have not come roaring back, are starting to show a little bit of growth. So I'd say that in the last week or two, the evidence has definitely shifted to the positive side that the end of the recession is in sight, and well, the consensus view is for sometime in the first quarter or second quarter of next year.
Greg, is there really such a thing, though, as a typical recession, and is this a typical recession?
No, it's a very good point. I would say that no two recessions are alike, and this one is definitely unusual on a number of fronts. First of all, is the extent to which this really began in the business sector and spread to the consumer sector. The reverse is usually the case. You usually get a situation where, you know, demand starts to outstrip supply, and the Fed gets worried about inflation and raises interest rates. That hits things like housing and car sales, and then with a lag, business investment follows. Exactly the reverse has happened this time. Businesses overinvested in everything from new clothing stores to fiber optic lines, and that stuff all started crashing down late last year, and it took about 6 months for the overall economy to follow suit, as witnessed in things like employment.
How do you read the stock market's bump up? Is it possible that that's just a little early euphoria over some successes in Afghanistan that could vanish or look less impressive in a couple of months?
There are certainly reasons to be skeptical. Yes, some of it is probably based on things that, like you said, like political developments, which we don't really know have a bearing on where stocks are going to be going and what corporate profits are going to do. And we also know that valuations are still extremely high. At today's level, stocks are trading at somewhere between 25 and 30 times trailing earnings. Now, it's roughly double the average price-earnings ratio of the last 50, 60 years. But that said, with each passing day, as this rally holds on, it gets harder to kind of discount what's going on. And there are some positive signs. Earnings, to be sure, are not roaring back, but they're not falling as fast as they were before.
You mentioned retail sales indicators. What about the Thanksgiving weekend that we just passed? How did the heavy shopping season weekend look?
Again, not a blowout, but on the other hand, not a wipeout, which in these troubled times is probably better than we could have asked for. One of the widely followed indicators is something done by the Telecheck National Retail Sales Index,
mm-hmm.
and it suggested that Black Friday, as they call the day after Thanksgiving, saw a sales increase from the year before of about 2.3%, which is not great, but compared to, for example, 6% in 1999.
But up is better than down.
Well, sure, and it's comparable to where we were, say, just as recently as 97, which was not a recession year.
Mm-hmm. How about the unemployment outlook? How does all this calculate for unemployment? Have we seen the worst of it?
Probably not. I mentioned a few minutes earlier that the number of people filing claims for unemployment insurance has gone down, but there's still a lot of them. In fact, there are still enough people flowing into the ranks of the unemployed that we're probably going to continue to see drops in across the economy in the number of people working for a couple of months. And just because the labor force continues to grow as, you know, people leave college and go looking for jobs, we could continue to see the unemployment rate rise to over 6% from about 5.4% now.
Particular sectors or industries where you expect to see more job losses?
The travel and tourism industry continues to be an area of concern, and that's because even though the airlines are doing a little bit better than they were in the immediate week or two after the terrorist attacks, they're still seeing far less traffic than they did this time last year. There are still a lot of people too worried to fly.
Greg, how about the global picture? If our economy is in a slump, is anyone else's economy revving up to help pull us out of this?
Unfortunately, no. If anything, the picture overseas is even grimmer than it is here. Japan has already had several quarters of negative growth. Their recession is well entrenched. In fact, I think it's the third recession they've had in the last decade. Germany has now recorded two negative quarters of growth, so they too are in a technical recession. So that's the three largest economies in the industrialized world now in recession. The United States is not going to be pulled out of this recession, I don't think, by the pull of demand from its trading partners. Essentially, the turnaround has got to come from within our own borders.
Interesting that both George Bush and his father got war and recession on their watch.
Yeah, and Bill Clinton managed to go 8 years without either.
The lucky man.
Yes.
Greg Ipp, thanks for joining us.
Sure, Tom.
Greg Ipp is an economics reporter with the Wall Street Journal. He spoke with me from Washington. The statistics are startling. 100 countries have undergone economic declines since the 1970s. During the 1990s, the numbers of the very poor grew by almost 500 million. And the UN estimates that the 15 richest individuals in the world are worth more than the combined GDPs of all sub-Saharan Africa. Post-September 11, these inequities somehow feel impossible for affluent America to ignore. What went wrong with globalization? Wasn't global trade supposed to fix this? Can we link the terror of September 11th and global inequity? And what can be done to balance the equation? You can join the conversation tonight at 1-800-423-TALK, 1-800-423-8255. Joining us in the studio is Richard Parker. He's a senior fellow at the Shorenstein Center at Harvard University. Good evening, Richard Parker.
Good evening.
Also with us tonight is our guest analyst, Robert Reich, former labor secretary in the first Clinton administration and now professor of social and economic policy at Brandeis University in Waltham, Massachusetts. Hello, Robert Reich.
Hello, Tom.
Richard Parker, what about it? We thought that globalization was supposed to lift all boats, and that in the 90s, if we pursued self-interest with great fervor and skill, we were doing a favor to the entire world. It didn't work out?
I don't think it worked out. I think that the problem was, first of all, that you had a rapidly growing population. Second, that you had a rapidly growing level of production that couldn't be absorbed in most of the third world because of inadequate income, and that the third world was in fact faced in the 1980s with a problem of paying back loans that it had acquired in the 1970s and which they couldn't pay back. And the IMF and the U.S. government and the World Bank all put them under what were called structural adjustment programs, which essentially said cut government spending domestically, which usually meant cutting health and education, first of all, and focus on export-led growth rather than production for domestic growth. The theory being that by selling exports, you would earn the currency to pay back the loans, basically loans that were made to New York and London banks.
Mm-hmm.
It was a good theory, I suppose, although I was critical of it right from the start. I think that the evidence is that fairly conclusive, actually, that what we've had instead of the growth that the model promised, and the model was based on some fairly standard neoclassical economic thinking, we've in fact seen the data that you've just cited. Now, the reasons for it are severalfold. One, cutting back health and education is probably a fundamentally bad thing to do. The history of the advanced industrial countries is that by investing in education and health and infrastructure of all kinds, that you get real growth.
And are you suggesting that somehow the policy of the 90s led to a global cutback in health and education?
No, it happened in the 1980s. By the early 1990s, there was, in fact, a recognition by the World Bank and the IMF and by all the multilateral agencies. And in fact, you had the same recognition by the World Trade Organization in Doha 2 weeks ago that, in fact, these policies hadn't worked.
So the heavy debt burden led third world countries to cut back on health and education.
Yeah. The heavy debt burdens of the 70s, mm-hmm. which were caused by the OPEC price rises in energy. And you have to remember that few of these third world countries had their own domestic oil supplies, so they, like the U.S., had to import, mm-hmm. caused them to undertake large debts.
So are you saying that they just weren't in a good starting gate for the 90s, but that the markets might have worked for them if they hadn't been so encumbered?
No, I think that the problem is that most of the market-oriented thinking of the last 20 years has forgotten the importance of institutions. That is, I remember my colleague Jeff Sachs, Bob's mm-hmm. old colleague Jeff Sachs, once saying that the only thing the world needs is markets and laws to enforce them.
Mm-hmm.
And it's nonsense. I mean, the history of development, whether you look at David Landis, you look at Charles Kindleberger, or you look at any work by highly regarded economic historians, people like Douglas North, who won a Nobel Prize in economic history, all show that markets alone don't lift societies out of poverty. They required complex social relations cultivated by government, social bargains, the building of what contemporarily is called social capital. And markets won't do it. And markets, in particular instances, like the Soviet Union, were an utter disaster.
We're going to come back and look at the failings of the markets, in your view, and what institutions might do. See if we buy that. See if Robert Reich buys it. But before we do, I want to put this one to you. Do you make the link, make the argument that somehow these economic problems in the third world are related to September 11th? You know, a lot of people we hear from here don't buy that right now. They say, look, these were upper middle class guys from Egypt and Saudi Arabia. These were not the impoverished masses of the world. It's wrong to make a connection between global poverty and the terrorist attacks of September 11th. But you're implicitly, maybe more than that, making that connection.
So of course I'm making the connection. I mean, it's fairly simple to do. I mean, Jefferson, Washington, Madison, and Adams weren't poor people and led a revolution in the United States. The leaders of the French Revolution were not in large part poor. Karl Marx was married to the daughter of a Prussian military official, and Lenin was the son of a school teacher. I mean, the leadership of these kinds of revolutionary and insurgent organizations, whether they're revolutionary from the left or counter-revolutionary from the right, seldom come from, you know, what in Marxist terms used to be called the proletariat, the very poor, the industrial poor. They come from the ranks of a middle class or upper middle class, and in some cases, the very wealthy. Zhou Enlai, Mao Zedong's right-hand man, premier of China for many years, came from a wealthy Chinese family.
Well, the next
I don't understand. I mean, it just seems to be an expression of the ignorance of people that they don't simply understand the connection.
Fair enough, but it's our world. The next level of that argument is this wasn't about the economy. This was about Islamic fanaticism. And Islamic fanaticism will not be solved by an extra bowl of noodles or an extra car in the garage.
You know something, German anti-Semitism wasn't just about the Jews. It was also about the economic suffering and the social humiliation of living under Germany in the aftermath of 1918. The connections need to be made. To try to imagine that you can create simple little boxes and say, this is political in a green box, this is economic in a blue box, this is social in a red box, is again nonsense. I don't understand. I mean, all you have to do is look at the base of support and its breadth to understand that, in fact, economics plays a profound role in all of this.
Robert Reich, do you see the thread going right through here from global poverty to September 11th?
There are relationships. They're not direct relationships, but I do agree that poverty creates the fertile soil in which you can generate terrorism. Demagogues thrive when people are oppressed, when they're hopeless, when they feel that their only alternative is to follow the direction the demagogues are directing them in. And this is not in any way and shouldn't be understood as a justification for terrorism. This is an explanation for one of the sources of and one of the reasons why psychopaths occasionally in history do gain followings. I'm not sure, Richard Parker, I would put Jefferson, Madison, Adams in the same category as some of the terrorists, but you are undoubtedly correct that revolutionary fervor comes from the middle class, from the professional class, and that you have behind them very often a lot of people who have very little to lose.
We're talking this hour with Richard Parker, senior fellow at the Shorenstein Center at Harvard University, and with Robert Reich about globalization and where we go now with it. Can we do better than we did in the 70s, the 80s, and the 90s? Did global poverty create September 11th? And can we push the threat of terrorism away by doing a better job of spreading the wealth? You can join the conversation by calling 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Do you buy it? Do global economic inequities create a breeding ground for terrorism? I'm Tom Ashbrook. You're listening to Special Coverage. This is Special Coverage from WBUR Boston. I'm Tom Ashbrook. We're talking about the global economy and asking whether the large inequities that have opened up over the last few decades are the breeding ground for the terrorism that we saw on September 11th. And if so, what can we do about it? You can join the conversation at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Is there a better way to spread economic growth around the world than we've been pursuing lately? We're joined by Richard Parker, a senior fellow at the Shorenstein Center at Harvard University, and by our guest analyst tonight, Robert Reich. Richard Parker, you made the case before the break that globalization and markets are not enough alone, but I think there's a lot of skepticism about foreign aid. Is that what we're talking about here as a substitute or a supplement to the markets? And how can we do it better than we did it last time?
I think the answer is, yeah, it's a discussion of foreign aid. And, you know, most every study that's done of the general American understanding of what U.S. foreign aid is so wrong that I think the problem is people's understanding of foreign aid, not foreign aid. That is, right now, the United States spends something like 0.3% of gross domestic product on foreign aid. Also, it ties almost all of that foreign aid to purchases made in the U.S., so that if we're to send something abroad, whether it's a pump or a truck or something else to help a third world country, it has to be U.S.-made equipment, even if that equipment's not the best equipment or the cheapest equipment for the third world. You survey Americans, and most Americans somehow think that foreign aid takes up something like 15% of the budget, and it's simply not true. So answer number one, yes, we are talking about foreign aid. I think that the example, though, is what we're seeing right now in the discussions of Afghanistan, which is the United States has recruited Europe, Japan, and Turkey into a multilateral coalition that's going to pool resources. And I think the model of pooling resources is absolutely essential. This isn't a job the United States can or should do alone. The United States can do a lot to provide leadership for both itself and others to take a first step.
But how do you use foreign aid in a way that really works? People think of fat Swiss bank accounts coming out of sub-Saharan Africa. A week ago, U.S. Treasury Secretary Paul O'Neill said, over the last 50 years, the world has spent an awful large amount of money in the name of development without a great degree of success. Do you disagree?
Let me answer the question, how can we spend it? I think, again, first of all, we need to do it multilaterally. Second, we need to focus in some cases on tangible projects that are fairly measurable, like education and public health. Third, we need to insist on a much higher degree of what economists call transparency in these transactions. A great deal of what Secretary O'Neill calls wasted foreign aid was wasted because it was tied to U.S. foreign policy objectives. We sent billions of dollars to oftentimes terrible countries that we knew were terrible in the first case because we were propping up a local general or a local corrupt politician because that politician happened to be in service of U.S. foreign policy objectives. I think that the world has changed. I think, first of all, there are a lot more educated people among governing elites around the world. Second, I think that there's a lot more capacity for transparency, a lot more sensitivity to the issue of transparency. And third, I think that there are metrics that we can use that are fairly visible and useful for deciding whether our aid is working.
Robert Reich, what about it? Do you agree that the enthusiasm for market-led growth around the world was overrated, and can institutions really step in and do a better job?
Well, I don't think it's either or, Tom. Market-based growth is still basically the way most of the world economy is going to grow. Foreign direct investment, investors feeling that there is a profitable opportunity to invest in a particular country, that's really the heart of development. But we need to accompany that with some serious structural reforms. I mean, we rebuilt Europe after the Second World War. We rebuilt Japan. It was all to our gain because those highly productive regions of the world became highly productive. They traded with us. They developed stable middle classes.
But they were highly productive before World War II. Somalia, Afghanistan, the Sudan were not.
But it is possible to engage developing nations in a virtuous cycle of growth. We can see it in Southeast Asia, for example. A lot of East Asian countries export us to us all sorts of sophisticated equipment now. 20 years ago, 30 years ago, they exported very unsophisticated toys to us. It is possible to generate these kinds of virtuous cycles, not just through foreign aid, but also through one very important mechanism, and that is debt relief. Many of these countries right now, developing nations, are under piles of debt to the developed world. They can't get out from under that debt unless they get debt relief. We've been talking about this for some years. The United States has put up a little bit of of money for debt relief, not nearly enough. Also, education. Richard talked about education, but there is no doubt that if you invest in education, particularly of women as well as men, you control population growth. And population growth is one of the things that's dragging poor countries into even more extreme poverty. The United Nations Population Fund reported just 2 weeks ago that right now the world population stands at 6.1 billion. It's projected to reach 9.3 billion by the year 2050, and all of that growth is going to happen in developing countries. 2 billion people right now lack sufficient food. They lack sufficient water. By 2050, it'll be 4.2 billion people living in abject poverty, unless there is some attempt to deal with population growth and deal with some of these structural problems.
Richard Parker, what do you think it means for global terrorism if we don't spread more of the world's wealth or create new wealth for that huge coming bulge in population growth?
Well, I mean, global terrorism has been going on for years. Global terrorism simply hasn't been high on U.S. radar screens because it hasn't been going on in big ways here, but it's certainly been going on in other parts of the world. The terror is an expression, in my opinion, of a complex set of factors that have to do with both the abject poverty that billions of people live in, their ability particularly now to compare themselves via television and modern advertising with the living standards in the West, and then a set of real conflicts that emerge out of cultures colliding with a Western-defined notion of what it means to modernize. We seem to have the idea that there's a one-size-fits-all way to grow. And we've spent the last 25 years trying to impose that one-size-fits-all way to grow on a large part of the world. And the evidence is it hasn't worked. But we are only at the beginning stages of trying to accept the idea of diversity in paths of growth.
We'll talk a little more about diversity in paths of growth, but I want to bring our callers into the conversation. We're talking about the global economy and whether, by growing it with a little more equity, we can diminish the threat of terrorism, improve the health of the world. What do you think? Do you buy the link between terrorism and global poverty? Do you think that we can do it better and make everyone safer? We're at 1-800-423-8255. Can institutions work more effectively than markets? Is there a way to harness them together more effectively than we've done in the past? Jim is on the line. Hi, Jim. You're on the air.
Good evening.
Hi.
My privilege, believe me. And I don't propose that I am an expert. I have convictions, but whatever.
We're happy to have you and your convictions.
I believe that the creation of wealth, and I think Mr. Reich would agree, the creation of wealth is central to the relieving of poverty in the world today. Certainly this country of Mexico, the nation of Canada, and those that have dealt with us in Europe are far sounder today than they were 40 years ago. And it's not because we gave them aid. We gave them aid, yes, but we also gave aid to a community of people that knew what to do with it.
So are you suggesting
they used their imagination to put things together and understanding what trade is, what manufacturing is, what engineering is?
Jim, are you suggesting that it's hopeless to give foreign aid to some parts of the world that are not as economically advanced?
No. I did not say anything about economically advanced. My purpose is we have to create, we are, our poorest people in this country alone are far better off today than they were 30 years ago. Maybe not relatively speaking, but they are living a higher standard than they certainly were 30 years ago.
So what's the bottom line, markets or institutional intervention or both?
I think there's a human element. There are some people, hey, you know, the old story, you can show a person how to fish or you can send them the fish. Some people will not learn how to fish.
Jim, thanks for your call. Richard Parker, you hear this skepticism here about the capacity, willingness, readiness of some populations to respond to opportunity, even if it's offered them. What do you say?
Look, I think what I want to do is get this conversation away from the markets versus aid nonsense. This is like talking about men versus women, who are better for, you know, conceiving children. I mean, I'm not advocating that we do only aid and public spending versus markets. The conversation here needs to ramp up quickly at least one level to understand that, like Professor Reich, I'm arguing for a notion of using a more balanced strategy that incorporates public sector assistance and public sector support along with markets.
But our caller Jim is suggesting that there may be some populations immune to the best balance of the two.
There aren't many of them, frankly. And the ones that we always seem to think are immune today, when we look back and think who was thought immune, it was the Irish 100 years ago.
Thriving now.
Thriving, seemingly thriving.
It economically.
Was, yeah. Italy, which was never going to rise out of its poverty. Spain, which was a basket case. Run down the lists of peoples and countries that have been marked off the list of possibilities 100 years ago or 200 years ago, and look at how well they've done. I'm not willing to say that somebody is out of the game.
So, Robert Reich, is anyone immune to doing better economically? And if you would, take us some way into this balance of market and institutions. How can we turn the dials here and do it better than we've been doing?
Well, we've talked a little bit about debt relief. We've talked about education. We've talked about fighting corruption. I mean, one of the biggest problems in some cultures, in some economies, in some societies, and we saw this in Russia, we saw it in Eastern Europe after the collapse of communism, is just you've got oligarchs who take the money and run.
But these are our oligarchs in the Middle East.
And the Middle
sort
East,
of.
Well, we have to examine, if we're talking about Middle Eastern economic development, our own foreign policies of basically propping up dictators, oligarchs, leaders that are not terribly interested in structural reform leading to strong middle classes and democracies. After all, you can't really get from here to there unless you go through a developmental phase in which you have a strong middle class at some point. You can't simply have a bunch of rich people at the top and then a very, very large number of people who are resigned to poverty. It just doesn't work. And our foreign policy, like our foreign economic policy, has to be designed to not only spread a kind of market orthodoxy, but spread a notion of institution building. Fighting corruption, investing in education, slowing down hot capital that simply rushes in and out of countries at the slightest provocation, speculative capital, making sure that countries can export to us their agricultural goods, their textiles. A lot of developed countries, like the United States, put up barriers to third world nations that want to export to us. Debt relief. There are many things that we can do. We're talking about a multi-prong approach to global poverty that weds our foreign policy to some humanitarian results.
We're talking about the global economy, what we can do to share the wealth, to share the growth more evenly. Do we risk creating new Afghanistans if we don't step in to help failing nations economically? You can join the conversation at 1-800-423-8255. Belinda is on the line. Hi, Belinda.
Hi there. I just wanted to say that it's so wonderful that you guys are having this conversation, because, and I hope that the folks who lost people in September 11th don't take it the wrong way, and that the only way we're going to sort of deal with this in a peaceful, or in a way that's going to lead to a more peaceful and just situation, is by examining the roots of inequality. And I know there are two kind of policy pieces that I think have been mentioned briefly, but that deserve more discussion in terms of equality. One is allowing poor countries to have a more protectionist trade regime and not be forcing them to open their markets to us while we don't open our markets to them.
Mm-hmm.
And secondly, debt relief by the private banks, because, you know, the proportion of money that is owed to the public institutions is a lot smaller than that to the private banks. And if U.S. and Western European banks were cajoled or forced into relieving a more significant portion of that debt, that would just go a huge way towards allowing poor countries to invest in their own infrastructure.
Belinda, good points both, and we thank you. Let's dig into them. Richard Parker, what about protectionism first? There's been a lot of pressure in the 90s to just open markets. Is Belinda right in saying that it's, and Robert Reich has suggested as well, that it's an inequitable kind of opening, that, you know, we want theirs open, but ours aren't? Should we permit developing nations to keep some closed markets? Is that an effective formula?
The fact of the matter is that most of the successful nations of the last 30 years, the developing nations, including the People's Republic of China, have maintained fairly stiff trade barriers. And what they're doing is following the models that Great Britain and the United States pioneered a century ago. It's important to remember that the chief source of revenue for the United States government up until the First World War was tariffs and excise taxes. Tariffs and barriers to entry on the part of foreign manufacturers was a longstanding policy of the United States, and we somehow did fairly well. The issue for me, though, I think is a little different. Most of the discussion of tariff levels nowadays is discussion of tariff levels that generally run at the level of less than 10% of a product's cost. 40 years ago, 50 years ago, 100 years ago, mm-hmm. we were talking about tariffs that ran at 50, 60, 70%, even, you know, luxury-like tariffs that ran at 100% or more.
So what's the implication?
Well, the implication is that this may not be as important an issue as those advocates who want to simply drive the tariff barrier levels down to zero, and that therefore what we want to do is worry a little more equitably about access of advanced industrial markets and their tariff barriers or their non-tariff barriers in all different sorts of ways, from spurious health requirements or other kinds of requirements, rather than worrying about getting the tariff barriers down in third world countries so that American manufacturers or European manufacturers or Japanese manufacturers can dump goods in those markets more efficiently.
Robert Reich, what about, you mentioned debt relief, and Belinda says, well, a lot of it is in the hands of private banks, a lot of these decisions. Is there leverage? Is it somehow there leverage to get the private banks to grant debt relief?
Yes, the United States has leverage. Developed nations have leverage. There are a number of proposals that have been put forward to help developing nations get out from under their piles of debt, working with consortium of banks. But let me just address another point that Belinda made. I think it's important for the purpose of this conversation that we understand that by addressing inequities in the world, we are not saying don't fight terrorism with guns. In other words, it's completely consistent to say let's be tough on terrorism, mm-hmm. but let's also be tough on the causes, the underlying socioeconomic causes of terrorism. They are not mutually exclusive. We need to do both. As to markets and trade, some of the best examples of rapid economic growth have been Malaysia, China. These are markets that are not open. The point is we shouldn't be religious. We shouldn't kind of impose an orthodoxy. Richard Parker was saying a moment ago, one size fits all. Some nations will benefit from a free trade, liberalized agenda. Other nations need to go through a stage of some degree of protectionism.
We're talking about the global economy and asking whether there's a better way of arranging things than we've had in recent years, a way more likely to produce global growth and less likely to produce September 11th-style terror. You can join the conversation at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Or you can join online at WBUR.org. You can find a tutorial on globalization at our website there. Click on Special Coverage. I'm Tom Ashbrook. You're listening to Special Coverage from WBUR Boston. This is Special Coverage from WBUR Boston. I'm Tom Ashbrook. We're talking about the global economy and asking, is there a better way to arrange it? Is there a better way to spread economic growth around the world? Do global economic inequities create a breeding ground for terrorism? You can join the conversation at 1-800-423-8255. Alan is on the line. Hi, Alan.
Pleasure, Tom, Richard, Robert. The question I have is twofold. One, I think healthcare in these countries should be directly correlated around family planning issues that's been cut back drastically over the last 20 years. Mm-hmm. And direct vocational training institutes in these countries funded by us and bypassing the local governments at hand so the money isn't filtered. By doing this, we're able to create a middle class that can support themselves, build their own houses, wire their own buildings, and basically be self-sufficient rather than handing the money through government agencies that just basically loot the funds.
You're saying go straight to the people without going through the local governments? How do we do that, Alan?
Well, similar to like the way the Soviet Union had done it in the past, they would build schools and hospitals and train these people. We've got to be able to set up something where we have a an arrangement where we're allowed to give them to train these people through our own schools with teachers that are employed by us. So we're giving them employment.
Got it.
While at the same time training them.
We got it, Alan. Thanks for your call. What about this notion? And it's in the air, it's in the columns of somehow bypassing corrupt or ineffective governments to take aid. And Alan is suggesting in particular family planning and voc ed. We've got our own political issues around family planning, but this sort of neo post colonial period notion of end running governments and imposing aid and development on nations with or without the government support. Richard Parker.
Well, I guess two reactions, one of which is there are lots of corrupt governments out there, and it is probably a very good idea to do things that bypass corrupt governments. Well, whoop-de-doo, that's not new news. The fact of the matter is that international aid organizations and private sector non-governmental organizations, CARE and the like, have been going in with direct assistance programs that bypass governments in the way that Alan describes for 50 years. The fact of the matter is the scale of resources moving through those pipelines has not been enough to address the fundamental problems.
So the question is, do we build bigger pipelines along those lines, or do we go back to the government approach?
If, in fact, everything is going to change in the aftermath of September 11th, I think one of the things that needs to change is this dreary 25-year-old Reagan-esque era, government screws up all the time and markets get it right all the time.
That seems to be changing right now.
Well,
to some extent, one
hopes. I mean, it's just dreary in its simplicity. We need to get to a more sophisticated discussion because it's not only boring intellectually and dishonest, but it is preventing us from getting to discussions that are richer and terms of solving the problems at hand.
Robert Reich, what about that? Richard Parker labels that as 25 years old, and indeed the origin is, but it was only in the Clinton administration where we heard about ending welfare as we've known it, that theme was still very much alive very recently. Do we have the political will or leadership in this country to move past that, even post-September 11th, and say, no, the markets aren't enough, we need some more institutional thought and structure in these programs?
Well, I think we've learned, Tom, and what's happened in Russia, in Eastern Europe, elsewhere around the world where government has essentially got out of the way, we've learned that market is not necessarily what you get when governments get out of the way. You might get a corruption. You might get kind of a chaos. We have a stake in institution building. Let's call it that. Building institutions that lead not only to responsiveness in terms of democratic governments, but also strong middle classes in which there is enough transparency. We use the word transparency, that is, a system of exchange and transactions in which investors can know what is happening to their money. Open books, bankruptcy courts, all kinds of things that we take for granted in this country that many places around the world need help setting up. That would be the best kind of aid.
Who's standing up and doing that? Who's going to take the horns of this challenge and follow through on it? Who's got the stature? Who's got the resources?
Well, the United States has got to assert some leadership here, Tom. It's not just a matter of going in and cleaning up the Taliban, going in to trouble spots around the world reluctantly when we have to, or when we're angry, or when we're directly threatened. We have got to take a role in which we organize a lot of developed nations around the world to help developing nations deal with their problems of very rapid population growth and economies that really are not yet economies, that cannot handle a lot of infusions of resource. The Bush administration, one of the first things it did was to say no foreign aid can be used for family planning.
Mm-hmm.
Well, that's exactly the reverse of what we need. I don't care, you know, what your religious kind of spiritual inclinations are. These countries do need help with family planning. If they don't get it, we're going to see a world population of, as the UN predicts, 9.5 3 billion people on the world, and the result will be devastation, environmentally devastating for all of us, but also devastating for these very crowded areas of the world.
Robert Reich, Richard Parker, let's turn to the phones once more. Mike is on the line. Hi, Mike. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
I agree with you that global aid is important, and I certainly agree that we need to get at the causes of terrorism. I just don't really see how you can make this assumption, and I think it is an assumption, that global terrorism rises directly from economic lack. It doesn't seem to follow to me. It seems that the terrorists are not coming out of the most economically needy countries. Afghanistan is not where the terrorists who were harbored by Afghanistan originated. They came from Saudi Arabia, which is, by and large, a much better off area. They came from other regions and were recruited.
Yeah, Mike, I don't know if you heard at the top of the hour, Richard Parker was asserting that if you look back in history, you've always got a more educated, well-off class that stands up to represent the interests of the impoverished or the somehow exploited. You don't buy that?
Well, it's not so much that I don't buy that. It's just that you're talking about terrorism. Now, where is this terrorism coming from? We have terrorism in our own country, right?
Yes, we have had.
We have had terrorism in our own country, and where did they come from? Were they the impoverished? No. The Unabomber wasn't an impoverished individual. The kids at Columbine, they weren't impoverished.
Richard Parker, here's the question again. Mike's just not buying the connection between the global economy, global poverty, and terrorism.
Well, good. I'm glad that's your position, Mike. Mine is different. I've stated it before. Go take a look at a book by a man named Barrington Moore called The Social Origins of Dictatorship and Democracy. It's 35 years old, and it will give you a fairly sensible, I think, introduction to the relationship between distribution of wealth and power and the ways in which the complex interactions of the two statistically are more likely to lead to the kinds of resistance that we are seeing today in the form of terrorism than not. My argument isn't that there aren't exceptions to a rule. I don't believe that human affairs is governed by an absolutism that says that there is a law in which A leads to B. What I'm asserting is a statistical correlation that I think most historians of just the last 200 years in Western history, as capitalism has developed, are fairly comfortable with. And it has been lost in the kind of tabloid journalism and discussion that we've had over the last 2 months.
Richard Parker, put your political antenna out here for a minute. Things are in a state of change, maybe. Do you sense that there's a fresh political willingness to look at a different approach to global poverty than we've seen in the last 25 years, where you decry the Reagan, perspective?
Two things. One of which is we've got a Republican president who is Keynesian. That is, you actually got a senator like Trent Lott who's Keynesian calling for domestic economic stimulus. And the argument is whether it should be $75 billion or $100 billion. So I think that the argument has actually been solved, and we haven't gotten around to recognizing it.
And you think that will be reflected in elections?
Well, look, let me – one more point. Colin Powell right now is designing a post-conflict redevelopment program for the Afghanis that looks like an awful lot like what in microcosm, taken up to a global scale, the United States is capable of doing and working on over the next 20 years. So, again, I think that events are actually outstripping rhetoric, and the responsibility now is for rhetoric and arguments to catch up with the changed world.
Robert Reich, you agree?
I wish I could be as optimistic as Richard is. I think that the United States is still basically an isolationist, fairly insular place. We don't know many foreign languages. Most of our children speak only English. Maybe we're becoming slightly bilingual with regard to Spanish, but that's imposed on many of us. We don't really tune into the rest of the world. We do when we're directly challenged. Right now, Americans are looking at the Middle East as we have not looked at the Middle East in perhaps ever. But how long is this really going to last, Tom? There is a tendency here to want to just pretend the rest of the world doesn't exist. Yes, we trade with the rest of the world, but that is the major foreign policy we've had in this country, opening up foreign markets.
On September 12th, we swore we were not going to look at the world in that lazy way again.
Well, I hope that this marks a sea change in the way we do think about the world, not only in terms of our national security, but also in terms of our leadership and obligations as the only remaining superpower in the world. But history doesn't suggest that we are there yet.
We'll see. Richard Parker, thanks very much for joining us tonight.
Thank you.
Richard Parker is Senior Fellow with the Shorenstein Center at Harvard University. And Robert Reich, thank you.
Thank you.
You can continue this conversation online. Go to WBUR.org and click on Special Coverage Forums. Two brothers, Charles and Jiwon Johnson, live together in Portland, Oregon, but they have sharply different views about Osama bin Laden and the U.S. war in Afghanistan.
Okay, I'm Jiwon Johnson from West Virginia. I came to Portland in 85 because it wasn't too much work back in West Virginia. I had my brotherhood been out here. He seems to think that America was attacked without cause, and I think it was attacked with cause.
If it wasn't named bin Laden, was any kind of a man, he'd come out there and face the world. I call him a coward.
I think he's a hero because he's standing up for his people and his religion.
He's standing up for himself.
For the ones that got killed. And I feel like, you know, like he's standing up to the most powerful people in the world because of the wrong that has been done to his people and his religion.
He keeps bringing that religion thing in there. Ain't no religion. Ain't no religion, man. Ain't God to believe in that kind of stuff. I've been in war. God ain't about no killing. I don't care what religion you are. But you walk in my door to attack me, I'm going to protect myself. I'm going to protect this house. I don't care whether you've been Laden or whomever. I got the stuff to kick your butt with. I'm going to kick it. Okay? And regardless of how far I got to go, what weapons I have to use, I'm looking for you.
I think it is a war against Islam. But, you know, I don't agree with the president because they say it's a fight against freedom, which I do think that they wish to terrorize their whole country because of things that happened over there. Like, because the United States, they have a policy just like, I feel like the way the United States came to be, it's all about conquering. Now it seems like they want to conquer the whole world, you know, the people who run the United States seem like they want to conquer the whole world and have everybody living the way that the United States does.
Okay, now look at it like this. When people say, I'm fighting for a religion, and I'm going to kill people, innocent people, God don't believe that. I believe it's a politic, money thing. If he wanted to kill up a lot of people, he could have took them planes and just flew them into Disneyland. But he went after the money markets.
I think about the civilians in Afghanistan. I think about the civilians from the Gulf War, because there's a lot of civilians killed then. And I think about, you know, soldiers, whatever, you know, it's all, there are people. You know, I feel like, you know, if you kill one person, it's just as bad as killing another person.
We don't control the bombs. We do not control the politics. I'm just a pawn. And the soldiers over there, they're pawns. Pay attention to your neighbors. Be there for your neighbors.
That was Charles and Jiwon Johnson from Portland, Oregon.